Okay, I think we'll get started. Thanks, everybody, for coming. This is great. I'm really quite pleased to introduce my friend and colleague, Steve Coltai, who currently works as a senior advisor for global entrepreneurship at the State Department. In this role, Steve is responsible for designing and implementing the Global Entrepreneurship Program that you'll hear about in a few minutes. The GEP is a new program focused on supporting and empowering entrepreneurs in Muslim communities around the world. And it's a demonstration of the U.S. government's long-term commitment to advancing entrepreneurship by providing expertise and tools geared towards building local capacity in the entrepreneurship sector. Steve was also very involved with serving as the secretariat for a deliverable after President Obama's speech in Cairo. Many of you remember the Cairo speech in the fall of 2009, or excuse me, in June of 2009. One of the follow-ups was when President Obama announced that there would be an entrepreneurship summit here in Washington, and that took place in April of 2010, and Steve was very involved in the organizing of that very successful summit. Had over 250 representatives. I was there, and what struck me and what was unusual about it for a summit was you had people like Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel Prize winner, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, staying the entire 2 days, sitting in the front row, taking notes and participating. You had people like Mo Ibrahim, the famous African billionaire, stayed the entire 2 days sitting in the front row. And these were people that wanted to be heard. They were responding to President Obama's call. And so I think it really struck a chord around the world. And you had a number of very significant influencers and doers actually in the room, but actually staying the entire time. If you've been to Washington summits, a lot of the time people show up for the first speech and then spend the rest of their time networking or eating the muffins out in the corridor. But this was a very different experience. So a lot of the credit goes to Steve for that. Steve had a past life. He has been a successful entrepreneur twice. He helped start the first European satellite television channel system, which is based in Luxembourg. It's now called SES Astra. And then he also started an events planning company that got venture capital financing. I got to know Steve through something called the Franklin Fellows Program. Henrietta Fore, who is a CSIS board member, but who at the time was Undersecretary for Management, suggested to Secretary Rice that there ought to be a program to bring in creative, accomplished people from the outside, from the private sector to help in the public sector. And so Secretary Rice, who knew Steve from the time they were together at the Council on Foreign Relations in the 1980s, asked Steve to come in as a Franklin Fellow, and he spent about 15 months as a Franklin Fellow. He's now a full-time staffer focused on these entrepreneurship issues. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over the microphone to my friend and colleague, Steve Coltai. Steve, over to you.
Thank you very much, Dan. It is great to be here. I'm one of many members of the Dan Rundy fan club that follows Dan around his career, having just come to CSIS probably, 4 or 5 months ago from IFC, where we met. I'd like to have a very sort of informal, casual conversation, and I thought that I would tell you a little about what we're doing and where we're headed with the entrepreneurship effort. The whole move to include entrepreneurship as a key element of American foreign policy is very much the main theme of my work and our work. And I should introduce Brian Klein, who is my colleague and works with me at the GEP at the State Department. We have been for some time working to do what I actually, when I first came into the government, thought already existed. I assumed that since entrepreneurship is sort of in the DNA of America, and since it is sort of central to who we are and what we are as a country economically, but in other ways as well, culturally, I had actually assumed that it was right up there with things like promotion of democratic institutions, civil society, human rights, economic freedom. I assumed that that it was in that same cluster of core American values that everybody had been talking about for a long time, and was actually quite surprised to find that that was not the case. It had never been put forward as a standalone core theme. And when President Obama gave his historic speech called New Beginning in Cairo in June of 2009, he talked about various ways for the United States to change the way it interacts with Muslim communities around the world. And one of the principal, you know, examples was to talk about entrepreneurship. And it was that sort of impetus that gave the green light to start to build what has now become, and what we are working very hard to make, not only a key element of U.S. foreign policy, but also a permanent part of the State Department. And in fact, to sort of jump to the end of the story, one of the things I'm most excited about is that just a few weeks ago, Secretary Clinton agreed with some recommendations that we have been developing for some months to do just what I've said, to create a full-time, permanent, funded, staffed program office at the State Department as a new part of the administration. So when, you know, I'm long gone and Brian is long gone, this will now be something that we continue to fund and support, which I think is extremely important and very exciting. It all has also, by the way, expanded substantially beyond its original roots, focused on Muslim communities. And so one of the things we're doing in 2011, which is our first full year of operation, is expanding to other countries. So just the quick description of the Global Entrepreneurship Program. The GEP is the sort of secretariat and the focal point for a number of initiatives, both at the State Department and on the interagency level, to promote entrepreneurship. And it does this in some very specific programmatic ways. We have five categories of partners: NGOs, corporations, foundations, academic institutions, and investors. And these are all not individuals, these are all organizations. And all of these five organizations, or group kinds of organizations, almost all already have the promotion of entrepreneurship internationally as one of their primary agenda items. So this is these are people who already get it and are already in this area. And one of the very first actually was Cisco, and I'm glad to see my good friend Marianne here from Cisco. But we have now close to 100 partners worldwide, of which I think you guys were probably in the first five. What we do with these partners is we have six categories of programming: identify, train, connect and sustain, fund, enable public policy, and celebrate entrepreneurs. And these six categories of activity are what we consider to be the essential loop to create a successful entrepreneurial ecosystem. And this, by the way, is true domestically as well as internationally. The partners that we have, we work with in two ways. One is programs that they currently have, where we try to strengthen those programs, and then programs that are driven by the GEP itself. which are implemented through partners. So everything we do is with partners. It's just that in the first category, they are programs that exist in partner organizations. And what we ask of partners, if they become a partner of the GEP, is simply that they agree to do something incremental to what they are already doing. In other words, we don't want to just be a marketing vehicle for all of the great things that our partners are already doing, because as I mentioned, all of our partners are already doing great things. And in many cases, it is the primary objective of the organization. For example, we have a great many NGO partners who are members of the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs, ANDE, which now has got over 100 members. And they are, by definition, all primarily focused on building entrepreneurship in emerging market countries. So when they become partners of ours, we ask that they agree to do something incremental. And we define incremental very simply. It's either a new country. So program you already have, but you're going to do it someplace you weren't doing it before, or deepening an existing program that you already have. The first category is simple to understand. You know, you provide training programs. You now agree to provide them in a new country, preferably a country in which we are focused, and I'll talk about the geographic focus of the program in a minute. Or if it's deepening a program, very often it's deepening a program by working smarter with other partners, often who are in adjacent areas. So, for example, if you run a business plan competition, 100 people enter, 99 lose, one wins, what happens to the 99 who lost? They should go into maybe a training program or a mentoring program or both, which are offered by other partners who may be doing that in the country you're working in. Your program is strengthened, their program is strengthened, and we now have the possibility of some more entrepreneurs starting successful enterprises out of those 99 who lost. So that's a very simple example of what we mean by deepening an existing program. Then there are programs that are driven by the Global Entrepreneurship Program itself. And these are, as I said, also managed, you know, and fulfilled with and through partners, but they're things that we have driven. And there are a few examples of that that I'll give you. One is we are very bullish about the expansion of angel funding networks to emerging market countries. As some of you who are in the entrepreneurship space will know, angel capital in the United States today is responsible for 90% of early stage funding. Less than 7% of startups are funded by venture capital today. And the percentage is decreasing of venture-backed firms, and the percentage of angel-backed firms is increasing. There are 165 member chapters of the Angel Capital Association of America and in the U.S. and Canada. And my last company, I'm from Los Angeles, my last company in Marina Del Rey was initially funded by angels, and I in turn have been a member of two or three angel groups across the country. And so the angel movement is an extremely important way to make available what is the most difficult capital in any startup, which is your first investor. And it is very often much harder to raise $100,000 first than it is many millions of dollars later. So my last startup, I ended up raising $40 million for in three rounds of financing. The first $150,000 was by far the hardest. And that's true of almost every entrepreneur everywhere in the world. It doesn't matter whether you're in Marina Del Rey or in Jakarta. So one of the things we're trying to do is work with the Angel Capital Association of America and many other local partners to start these angel groups. That's an example of a GEP-driven program. Another example of a GEP-driven program is that we seek to put entrepreneurs in residence in countries. This is a concept that's very familiar in the venture world. VC firms and incubators and so forth have had entrepreneurs in residence in this country for 25 plus years, kind of a new idea internationally. These are people who primarily are experienced in the entrepreneurship ecosystem, preferably diaspora people who have a good knowledge of the countries in which they work in. They are not U.S. government employees. They do not work out of our embassies or aid missions. They are in the entrepreneurial community, so they're at the local EO chapter or the local YPO chapter or local university. And they are funded in some way, in whole or in part, by the USG. So our first two pilot countries for this program are Egypt and Indonesia. We have 15 focus countries. Nine of them are Muslim majority countries, six are not. And the first four are Egypt, Indonesia, Turkey, and Mexico, which we consider to be the next tier markets, sort of the next BRICS. And in the places where we have the full menu, which is these kinds of countries, where we offer all of our programs or as many of our programs as we possibly can, we do put an entrepreneur in residence in country. So in Egypt, which I just came back from leading an entrepreneurship delegation, which I'll talk about in a minute, which is one of our other programs, we just established a four-person office in Cairo and Alexandria, funded in the case of Egypt by USAID. Other countries we're working in, Indonesia, which is the second place I commute to, is funded in large measure by the private sector. Only a minority source is the USG. So it's different strokes for different folks depending on the country, but the concept is the same. These are people who are working full-time on the ground to do nothing else but run the programs that I've talked about, the synergistic programs among partners and the GEP-driven programs. The third GEP-driven program that I'll just mention, and that will be the end of the introduction, are these entrepreneurship delegations. We have a variety of programs where we actually are bringing people to and from countries. We run a speakers bureau. There are as in every sort of specialty area, there is a calendar of events. There are entrepreneurship events almost every day somewhere in the world. We maintain a calendar, and we very often are asked to send speakers or provide speakers for visiting groups that often come through other State Department programs, visitor exchange programs. So we have entrepreneurs, academics, investors, primarily those three categories in a speakers program. The entrepreneurship delegations are very successful, and we just completed what I think is probably a new high watermark for that kind of program. We had a group of 12 very prominent early stage investors and entrepreneurs who came with us to Egypt. And we had a 3.5-day trip, which is par for the course. Usually they're three and a half days plus a day or two of optional luxury travel, all of which the members pay for themselves. And the trip to Egypt was extremely successful in my mind for a number of reasons. One is it was, you know, sort of front page news, so it raised the level of conversation substantially. We had over an hour long meeting with the Prime Minister, after which he and I did a press conference on the importance of entrepreneurship to building jobs, creating jobs in Egypt, which was two or three days before the events in Tunisia, so it was particularly
timely.
But what was especially exciting to me about this particular delegation is that we had over 100 startups who were put forward by a number of our partners. In Egypt, we have about 40 GEP partners, both U.S. and Egyptian. So all of our partners, those five categories I mentioned, are both international as well as local in the countries we work in. And so we had over 100 startups that were put forward through a process of elimination. We ended up looking at six finalists, of which two were selected as winners and split a $40,000 cash prize that was kicked in by the delegates themselves. All of which were announced in a very large event with almost 1,000 people that was covered by the national media. what we also did in this event was prior to the finale, the showcase finale, over 50 of the unsuccessful. We had 32 semifinalists, and 50 of the non-semifinalists were allowed to do 20-minute masterclass mentor workshops with the delegates. So you could sign up as a company. We had the profiles of all the delegates, and you could sign up for a 20-minute chunk of time to talk to one of these people about your company and what your problems were. And so to make a long story short, out of this entire, we're still collecting the data, but there were 8 companies that received some level of funding, which means several of the companies that were not even finalists or semifinalists received some level of funding from members of the delegation. There were many more than that who were asked to enter into due diligence discussions. There were several sort of strategic alliances that were formed. In fact, there were a few that were created right there on the mentoring floor. There was one of our delegates who was a very successful entrepreneur who started CarMax, which is now a $6 billion company and is the largest used car store in the world, put together a specialty printer and a digital media company that was looking for specialty printing services. They'd never met each other, and he put them together, and they became a customer and supplier right there in the room. So it was a very, very exciting, and most of this was captured by bloggers and tweeters that we had with us, as well as the traditional media. So the level of energy that was created by this in Egypt was really very exciting, and that's what we try and do on these entrepreneurship missions. There are 4 to 6 a year, and upcoming ones will be going to Maghreb, Indonesia, and Turkey. So that's sort of the end of the commercial. The one thing I will say in terms of follow-up is that we are always looking for new partners. So if your organization is any one of those 5 categories, NGO, corporation, foundation, academic institution, or investor group, it would be great if you wanted to sign up to become a GEP partner. We have partner packages. I have a few hard copies that I brought with me. And you can reach me or Brian or the rest of our small team at entrepreneurship@state.gov. Entrepreneurship@state.gov is our email.
Thanks, Steve. As moderator, I'm going to take prerogative and just ask an opening question, because I suspect there'll be other folks that will have them. This is really, truly tremendous. I was aware of much of this, but wasn't aware of all of it. And it's, I found myself so pleased to listening to what you had to say, because I do think that the issue of entrepreneurship has got to be one of our primary assets of soft power in this country. And just the way you're describing the way people came forward in a country like Egypt, I think speaks to that. And in a different, we often think of sports diplomacy or Hollywood. I actually think the real Hollywood are people like Bill Gates or people founders of CarMax, who are people that people get that. I think my big takeaway from my time at IFC at the World Bank Group was the massive hunger in developing countries for business training and entrepreneurship training. I was saying to you earlier that IFC has a partnership on SME training with a large technology company, and it gets 5 million visits a year in 17 languages in 30 countries. And that says to me that there's a massive, massive hunger out there. And IFC also has a different product where it's sort of what I described to you, and this dates me, is sort of the Encyclopedia Britannica version of an MBA, and it's 35 volumes, and you buy them as books. And in Vietnam, this book program MBA sells more copies in Vietnamese than Harry Potter does. So I think the hunger is out there. Tell me about, and so that those are some of my prefacing comments, just to say, tell me about how you found the reaction in the interagency process, if you can, knowing that this, you know, obviously there's some education to do in terms of some folks not being aware of the opportunity, but obviously you're having some partnerships within the interagency process. If you could talk about the roles of some of the different, and maybe some of the promising opportunities that may be lying ahead in that.
How many people have worked in the executive branch before? So for somebody, you know, Dan was talking about this Franklin Fellow Program. And the Franklin Fellow Program is, you know, when you cut away all of the fancy layers, what it really is it's a program to bring old people into the State Department. And the one criteria that they have is you have to have 25 years of non-government experience. And most people are... I mean, they have academics, they have artists, they have business people, you know. And my background is primarily in the entertainment business. Most of my career was in the entertainment business. I ended as head of the operating committee at Warner Brothers. So I've been in the entertainment business a long time. I'd never worked in the government before. And so when people, friends of mine ask me, you know, what's it like working on entrepreneurship in the government? What's it like working in the government? The first thing I say is it's sort of a parallel universe to the America that I know. And there are some very different rules. It's a parallel universe because everyone speaks English. They all look like the same people I've worked with all my life. There are just these sort of time shifts. There are a lot of things that are very different for somebody coming from the private sector, which, by the way, I think should be, I mean, this Franklin Fellow Program and the whole concept of bringing more people from outside government into government for a short period of time, not forever, because then you kind of go native. But to bring people in for a short period of time to leaven and reconnect government to America, I think is a really important thing that we don't do enough of, just commercial. So a lot of the practices that I would be familiar with coming from, you know, the business world are very different. In the business world, when the CEO of the company says, we are all going to, you know, paint our office doors yellow tomorrow morning, then when you show up for work at 8 a.m., everyone's office door is yellow. And there's usually a race for who can get there fastest to paint their office door yellow. In the government, it's slightly different. In the government, when you arrive the next morning, first of all, there won't be anyone there at 8 a.m., but also the yellow memo will need to be vetted, will need to be cleared. The legal advisor's office will have to comment on it. It'll have to be advised to the Hill. You'll have to have some consensus building. You'll need to talk to all of the other agencies about their views on yellow. There will need to be a study probably done by an outside contractor for $10 million on the value of yellow and its relative merit compared to other colors. And a year later, if anyone remembers that there was ever even a decision to paint all of your doors yellow, there will be one person who was around then and has not since been rotated out to being the consular officer in Quito and is still in the building, who will remember the yellow memo. So creating synergistic movement within the interagency, which is why Dan asked the question, is not without its challenges. Having said that, I'm a very big believer in working in the system. And the fact of the matter is that there is no institution on the planet that has the resources of the U.S. government. Exactly. So when you look at some of the institutions we work with most closely, which are USAID, OPIC, and several parts of the State Department, cultural exchanges, I won't go into all of the acronyms, but there are several parts of the State Department that are particularly relevant to what we do. We're very focused, for example, on women's entrepreneurs, women entrepreneurship, and that is an area that has a lot of resources. So there are those agencies that we work with, but I have to tell you that in many ways, I actually find it easier to work with the five outside groups than with some of the sister agencies.
Fair enough. I'll open it up for questions. I have several myself, but I'll call my friend from the MCC.
Thanks.
But push the button.
Thanks very much for your presentation. It was very, very interesting. Can you speak a little bit about some of the interagency coordination that you actually do. And do you, to what extent does your office have a program budget for implementing these things, or are you just a convener?
Sorry, I'll ask everybody just to identify themselves and who they're with.
So I'm Stephen Gall with Millennium Challenge Corporation.
Two very important questions. The first is that we do have an interagency group, which we meet with regularly, which includes USAID, OPIC, and MCC. And the principal person at MCC, who's the liaison there, is Francis Reed, by the way. And so we try very hard to work within existing programs of sister agencies, and some of the funding comes from these places. So as a brand new program, we did not have any funding in the beginning. That is now changing, and I hope it will continue to change rapidly. But I always hasten to add that even though there was no direct funding, there were actually quite a few funds. So, for example, I told you about the Entrepreneur in Residence program in Egypt, in those two cities, four people. That's $1 million commitment by USAID, which comes under an existing USAID economic development program. Similarly, if you look, for example, at Millennium Challenge Corporation, we're hoping and working very hard to include some of the entrepreneurship programs that we've been working on in Indonesia as part of the Indonesia compact that's currently under discussion. So there are a great many programs. OPIC is a wonderful example. There was an OPIC representative who was with me on this last delegation to Egypt. OPIC, as part of the presidential summit that Dan referenced, came up with a $430 million leveraged 4-to-1, so, you know, almost $2 billion worth of funding, technology and innovation fund for emerging market countries, MENA, startups, tech. So there are a great many partner agency programs within the State Department, ECA, the Educational and Cultural Exchanges, the International Visitors Leadership Program, IVLP, METPI, the Middle East Partnership Initiative, which is quite deeply funded. So we try wherever we can to work with and through partner agencies. Having said all of that, the thing that I'm most excited about that I started in the beginning is by institutionalizing this entrepreneurship effort, Secretary Clinton has agreed that we will have dedicated funding, a line item in the budget, and actual genuine real headcount. So the details of how that works is you know, as they say, the devil is in the details. And so making all of that happen is an enormously difficult, important, complicated process. But my colleague Brian Klein, who has the lead on it, is absolutely determined to be successful and will be in making all of this happen. So we will have dedicated funds, in the current fiscal year.
Yeah, Doug Mallinger.
Doug Mallinger, lots of hats, but have a company called Foundation Source, which runs about 1,000 family foundations, and partner in a private equity firm, and trustee for a college that's focused on entrepreneurship. But
and a Horace Greeley alum.
And a
like
Horace
me.
Greeley alum. My question actually is about what you're seeing on the ground, and just to give you a little bit of context and what I'm hoping to hear is, when I was at Syracuse University after Horace Greeley in 1983, I convinced the university to let me create a major in entrepreneurship, and I was the first at Syracuse and one of the first five people in the world to have a degree in entrepreneurship. Back then, when I went to the university to do this, they thought I was completely insane. There was no such thing as entrepreneurship. And, you know, after multi-years, got them to do it. And that ultimately launched something called ACE, which was the Association of Collegiate Entrepreneurs, which then launched YEO, the Young Entrepreneurs Organization. Back in the early 80s and the late 70s when I started, it really was still somewhat heresy to start a business. You know, the culture in the United States, while we've always had an entrepreneurial environment, actually has gone up and down in terms of an entrepreneurial way, because for much of the time it's actually been, you go work for somebody else. And when my dad started his company in the 60s, literally his mother almost just disowned him. How could he do this to the family? You know, to go out and take a risk to start a business. In the early 80s, every article that was written about a young entrepreneur would talk about the whiz kids. We weren't real entrepreneurs. We were just these crazy one-eyed creatures. So in the United States, it is a badge of honor for failure. In many countries around the world, if you fail, game over. So I'm interested in what you're seeing now in both the cultural aspects, the educational ecosystem to actually start bringing this up and providing some of the skills, and then ultimately the government infrastructures that enables people to actually start businesses without it being a complete nightmare and enables the investment capital to flow. Because even in the United States, before 1978, there wasn't even a venture industry because there was the prudent man rule that didn't come into effect till 78. So, you know, we've learned a lot in the last 30 years, and I'm interested to see how that's translating now to these countries.
So cultural issues in terms of accepting failure, but also the broader issue of enabling environment, and I can touch on that if you, but I'm sure you probably have a view on that as well. But
well, the cultural issue I think is really central, and it's what you know what you're describing is almost universally true everywhere in the world. You can't generalize, but there are very, very few places, and none that I've ever been to, where you know, being an entrepreneur is sort of your parents' first wish for you. That's almost never true. And so, but one of the things that's interesting about this that I've learned in doing this work is that the similarities far outweigh the differences, and that's true domestically and internationally. So the culture of entrepreneurship is a fuzzy thing, and it is almost in every case very much in need of bolstering. And it's why the sixth plank of our program is called Celebrate Entrepreneurs, because I think that the very best way to start to chip away at that, and you're only going to chip away at that, is to glorify the real life stories. You know, I mean, I come from the entertainment business, and I'm a very big believer in the power of real stories. And so we, you know, that's why we are so focused on what in the State Department we call the public diplomacy aspect of this, telling the stories of the real people. Part of the benefit of promoting entrepreneurship from a political standpoint, the reason why, you know, your tax dollars at work are well spent doing this, is that everyone knows, you know, the international financial institutions as well as the U.S. government, that there are lots of positive side effects of promoting entrepreneurship. And one of them is, generally speaking, a inside pressure to bolster civil society and the rule of law. So if you're, you know, a U.S. company that has intellectual property, for example, Microsoft or Pfizer or Warner Brothers, and you are losing substantial amounts of revenue because of the infringement of that intellectual property, we can do all, we can, you know, go to as many conferences and bilateral trade sessions and jump up and down as we want to encourage people to enforce IP. But when your own homegrown software developers, like the ones that we were promoting in Cairo, refuse to stay there or to register their patents there because there are no teeth in the Egyptian patent regime or commercial courts that will enforce your patent, then the Egyptian government has a different view and tends to listen differently to that. So the enabling environment is critical. But our view is that in addition to all the things that USAID, that the World Bank, that the IFC, that the Department of Commerce, that the IMF, that all of these external organizations do from top down, that there's also possibly a benefit in doing some of this from the bottom up internally in country with your own people. So one of the benefits of, and one of the reasons why one of the six other planks of the program is enabling the public policy environment, is that we have local partners talking about issues like the example I just mentioned.
Just one other added. The one thing I would highly encourage you to consider doing if you're not already going down this path, and I would say if I think back over the last 30 years that I've been involved with this, the one thing that brought the biggest effect in this country and really around the world was when 1984 we started, but 85 was the first official list of the top 100 young entrepreneurs under the age of 30 based upon revenue. So the first list was people like Michael Dell in his first year in business, and Steve Jobs, and you know, Mitch Kapoor, and Bill Gates, and the founder of I Can't Believe It's Yogurt, and California Closets, and all these companies that became very large companies. But the credibility of that list, what ultimately then generated was the Inc. 500 came from a lot of those activities, and then the Entrepreneur of the Year program with Ernst & Young came from those activities. But this is the first time that a list was actually created which became the heroes for the young entrepreneur movement that ultimately took off with the web in the 90s. But it all started with those early activities of Celebrate, and I couldn't agree more with you about the importance of that. Now, in places like Mexico, they probably don't want to be known because they can only get killed or kidnapped, but you know, certain countries, this would probably work in a big way.
Let me just make two comments on that, and then I know there are other questions here I want to recognize. Just on this issue of the enabling environment, I think one of the most successful programs that's not recognized outside of sort of a small community of specialists is something called the Doing Business Program, and the related consulting and advice work that the World Bank Group does, and it falls under a group called, I think it's called, it used to be called FIAS, which is not a very good name, but basically it's a business enabling environment type consulting work. But the Doing Business agenda is the, it force ranks countries and names and shames countries by how easy it is for you to start a business. And so people don't get, countries don't get upset about how they compare to Switzerland or the United States. What happens is there's regional competition. So Georgia gets all upset if they're 50 countries behind Azerbaijan or Armenia, or if I'm Colombia and I'm somehow behind Ecuador by 20 rankings, people want to understand why. And there have been a number of incredible, they've had a series of very successful changes in how governments support the broader enabling environment, which ultimately helps with this issue of entrepreneurship. And this has been a movement or a program of the World Bank. I'd say it's one of the most successful programs in the World Bank system. There are some countries in the World Bank system that do not like, there are people that do not like this program. Labor unions don't like it because one of the metrics has to do with how easy is it to hire or fire somebody, and some people, for some reason, don't think it's a good idea to be able to fire people. Don't ask me why, but that seems to be a that seems to be an issue. The other is there are some countries in Europe, and specifically France, that hate it because they're for a variety of reasons they don't do well on the metrics, and so they've and there are also professional jealousies in the bank system, and so there's some bureaucratic jealousies, and people don't like having the fact that this is successful and it's not a mainstream lending program. But I'd say it's been one of the most successful things that the bank does. The U.S. government provided both the early money for it and is one of the largest funders of the program, and provided the early political capital in the bureaucracy to get it done. People such as Josette Sheeran, who's now at the World Food Program, Andrew Natsios, who was then aid administrator, provided the very early, and then a lot of very thoughtful Foreign Service officers at aid provided the seed funding for this very important program. So this is around enabling environment. But the bank group, including IFC, has this force ranking system, but then it also has this consulting practice that basically goes to governments and says, hey, you're number 150 out of 160. I can help you move 30 points. Here's the recipe for how to do it. Why don't you hire me and we'll do this together. And oftentimes that's funded with donor, meaning U.S. government monies or other European donor monies to help make that happen. On the issue of telling stories, Steve is very aware of a program called Pioneers of Prosperity, which is a program that's been funded by various folks, including the Templeton Foundation most recently, but it's run out of by one of my friends, Michael Fairbanks, and it's run by a group called Seven Fund, S-E-V-E-N. And it's basically the Oscar Awards of entrepreneurs in developing countries. And so they've done one in the Caribbean, they've done one in Central America, and they've done two in Rwanda. And they basically comb the world, the region, five or six countries for great, compelling entrepreneurs. They bring the top 10 finalists to a country. They have the head of the state host a gala dinner. And then they get an Oscar award-winning documentary filmmaker to film shorts on each of the 10 finalists. Now, I never thought that rattan furniture makers could be so compelling as a film, or an eight branch family bakery could be compelling. These are incredibly compelling film shorts. And so it's about making this real and compelling and telling a story in a way that uses media that, for those of us in the policy world or in the international development world, that this is not sort of a natural thing for us. So I think you're on to something, and that's a very interesting and promising route, is the pioneers of prosperity. So Ashley, you've been waiting patiently, so I'm going to call on you next.
Hi, good morning. Ashley Chandler, CSIS. I'm going to shift this a different direction. I recognize that you guys are a young program and about to be an official part of the State Department as far as funding goes, which I imagine means growth and expanding outside of your initial four pilot programs. Now, I don't think anybody would accuse Mexico or Egypt of being easy places to work, but with regards to stability, they're relatively stable if you look at where a lot of U.S. dollars are being spent right now in comparison. I'm wondering if there are plans or if you have aspirations or if there's talks to segue programs like this into some of the more conflict-ridden environments. For example, in Afghanistan, bullets are still flying, but you've got a DOD task force that's on the ground trying to bring business development, entrepreneurs, kind of trying to make these connections that you guys are doing. And I was just wondering if the State Department has aspirations to kind of segue that way, or how would you like to grow in the more stable environments or unstable?
It's a really good and very important question. And, you know, I, as a business person, I always think that there ought to be some deliverables that come out of every meeting. So one of the deliverables out of this meeting is that, further to my yellow door example, we have had virtually no success at integrating. We are having a hard enough time explaining inside the State Department the importance of entrepreneurship, much less doing it outside the State Department, particularly at the Department of Defense. So while there is a lot of discussion, and there are lots of articles published, and there are lots of conferences held on things like expeditionary economics and the importance of entrepreneurship in conflict and post-conflict states, the fact of the matter is that, you know, we are fairly agnostic about the countries we work in. What our expertise is the programs. We think we know how to harness people around specific programs that really do change the entrepreneurial ecosystem in a country. We are not experts at figuring out necessarily which of those countries we should be turning our attention to. And I want to say on that score that there are three criteria that we use to pick the countries we work in. And this whole effort of picking countries is really important when you have, you know, even, I mean, right now we have a staff of five and a budget of zero. And there are, you know, 180 countries in the world where we have diplomatic relations. Probably 179 of them would be interested in bolstering their entrepreneurial environment, because there is very few people who don't understand the connection between entrepreneurship and job creation and economic growth. That's not a tough sell. So our challenge is figuring out where to deploy these scarce resources. So we have three criteria that we use to select these countries. The first is foreign policy importance to the U.S. of the country. The second is how close are they to the tipping point to go entrepreneurial, which I'll come back to in a minute. And the third is level of commitment by the U.S. ambassador and embassy to helping us get started in that country, because we rely very heavily on working with posts, as we call them. So the second criteria, the tipping point criteria, is really important. And Dan talked about the World Bank Doing Business indicators. I travel the world with the one-page summary of those indicators. It's kind of beaten up because it's been everywhere. And every single place I go, the shorthand version, and it's a much longer conversation, but the shorthand version of this is, let's see, you were number 112 last year, you're 118 this year. Explain to me again how committed you are to bolstering entrepreneurship in your country. So, you know, it is not the only metric we use, but it is the central metric because it is a composite of so many other indicators. There is something called the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor, the GEM report, and there's actually tomorrow? I'm speaking, a keynote speaking at their conference, which is their annual conference that talks about entrepreneurship indicators. And I commend all of you to check out the report, the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor, which is now in about 25 countries, also USAID funded. Many of the same metrics as the World Bank Doing Business Indicators report. However, there are a few additional ones that they have that I think are really great and interesting. And some of those have to do with public polling about intention to start a business, particularly among young people by demographic group, which is really interesting. And by the way, as an example, in according to that metric, just that one metric, the propensity in Egypt is 7. The propensity in the United States is 6. So there are, you know, as with most things, there are nuances to everything. Nothing is black and white. There, it's always shades of gray. So when you look at some of these countries, you know, it's very important to get beyond just the regulatory environment. You have to look at the people. You have to look at what people are, you know, if your view of Tunisia, just to pick a current story, was what, you know, you knew and learned about the Tunisian government and Tunisian politics, you would have entirely missed the point of what happened in the past week in that country. So we're very focused on looking at, you know, what some of these other indicators are as well. But the big deliverable is, we're sitting at CSIS, which is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most respected foreign policy think tanks in America, particularly with respect to security-related issues. To me, and I think it's one of the reasons Dan wanted to have this conversation, to me, the connection between economic stability and security is sort of fundamental. And some of you will know, I mean, the tagline of my footer is, you know, world peace through entrepreneurship, because I don't believe that you can have a stable, politically stable society that has a 35% official unemployment rate in the 60% of the population that is under the age of 26, which are the statistics for Egypt. So there are 20 million unemployed people in Egypt, of which 10 million are men. So when you have 10 million unemployed men, and a substantial number of those are college educated, like the two who killed themselves this week, who can't find a job ever, that's bad for world peace. That's bad for the United States. That's bad for the stability of Egypt. And the single most important, the single most effective way to change that I know of is through entrepreneurship, because in the United States from 1985 to 2005, all net job growth, every single new job in the United States, was created in a smaller, medium-sized enterprise that was less than 10 years old. The Fortune 500 or the established companies, because the Fortune 500 is not the right metric to use anymore, since there are many entrepreneurial companies that are now in the Fortune 500. But established traditional large American businesses shed jobs in that period of time. And that is even more true in developing countries which don't have multinationals, where their entire economy is basically SME focused. So it's extremely central to security issues.
Meredith.
How does what you do compare to What the Foreign Commercial Service does that to the country?
They're totally different. The Foreign Commercial Service's job is to increase U.S. exports. And increasing U.S. exports, full stop. That's their metric. That's how people are judged. That's how they're promoted. It is about increasing U.S. exports. And, you know, you could argue, and I do argue, that a rising tide raises all boats, and that economies that become wealthier are much better customers. And there are a great many U.S. companies, of which Cisco is one, who recognize that growing your markets is essential to growing your company. So there is a close connection, but their tack and their strategy for, you know, what they do is really kind of one step removed from what we do, which is very directly focused on promoting entrepreneurship.
My friend from Cisco.
Good morning. I'm Marianne Simikowski from Cisco Systems. I'm actually the Cisco Entrepreneur Institute specifically, and I just had two comments. First, just to amplify Stephen's response regarding the importance of working in global, you know, conflict-ridden zones. Just as an example, and I think this really illustrates Stephen's role as convener and catalyzer. And Stephen introduced Cisco to many partners, both through GEP and also through the Partners for a New Beginning. And as part of Cisco's commitment, working with partners, we just established a Cisco Entrepreneur Institute training center in West Bank, Gaza. I'm truly not here to try to promote our work, but rather just, again, to illustrate how the partners can really collaborate and work to achieve economic and social stability in conflict zones. So that's just one example of, you know, a commitment by partners to support both GEP and also the Partners for a New Beginning. And then a further comment, I just really would like to congratulate and enormous congratulations to Stephen and his team. I first met Stephen actually through Dan. Dan introduced us, I think it was October 2009, so just about a year and a half ago. And at that time, I was so impressed by Stephen's commitment and zeal and enthusiasm, as well as his agenda. And, you know, he had those six pillars that he wanted to put forward and really support. And we talked a little bit about some of the inherent challenges of working within the USG, as well as the opportunities that it brings. And I have to say, I'm just so incredibly impressed, especially coming from the corporate sector, where we do paint our doors yellow probably by 6 a.m. the next morning, because we know someone in Dubai had already done it, you know, 9 hours earlier. So there is such just truly an impressive amount of work that's already been accomplished by GEP. It really does, I think, herald that sort of corporate mentality in that sense as far as deliverables. So I just have to thank and congratulate Stephen, and it's truly an honor to work with Stephen and his team and with the whole GEP program.
Meredith.
I didn't. No, I was. We were friends because we shared a minute office at the Council on Foreign Relations on the sixth floor for a year. But I got the Franklin Fellowship in the previous administration, but I took it up in the current administration.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Lauren Citrome from the Center for International Private Enterprise, also Tufts alumnus. So at SIPE, we work with business associations as members of civil society to reform the environment for entrepreneurship, and that's a big part of what we do. We were talking about reforming the environment for doing business, and SIPE is also one of the core institutes of the National Endowment for Democracy. So we believe that in order to reform the environment, you need to have either working in a democracy or close to a democracy. And I was wondering if that affects the countries where you do programs when you're reforming business environments.
The three criteria that we have are the three criteria. So foreign policy importance to the U.S., where you are on the tipping point to go entrepreneurship, and we tend to favor countries that are between 9 o'clock and noon on that scale, and a level of commitment by post. Our primary objective is to increase jobs in countries. And the theory is that there are a whole bunch of ripple effects, that is what builds a middle class, that building a middle class is essential to creating a democratic society, that when the middle class is threatened or disappears, usually that's a bad thing for democracy. Everything you're saying is very much part of the ether of what we're doing. It is not, however, the driver, because precisely if you only go where the problems have been solved, then how much are you really contributing to solving the problem? So in a way, working in places that are not necessarily democratic in our definition, and I would cite Egypt as an example, having just come back from there 48 hours ago. We think that what we're doing is really important to laying the groundwork for that. Now, by the same token, and it's very interesting, you know, if you compare some of the countries we're working in deeply at the same time, Indonesia and Egypt as two examples. You know, Indonesia, which absolutely was not a democracy and has come a very long way, It's at a place where, you know, building entrepreneurship and building the middle class, we think, is essential to hanging on to the inroads and the progress they have made. Egypt is not yet at the same place, and therefore the medicine is the same, but for a slightly different reason. There, building the middle class is essential to get them to the place that Indonesia is sort of at now. So it's a continuum. There's no black and white. There are shades of gray, and we think that, you know, what we're doing, and I'm sure many of you know. I mean, one of my most favorite sort of academics on this subject is Vali Nasser, who spends some time now at the State Department, particularly working on Pakistan, and you know, he's written two books. The most recent book about the importance of the middle class and the rise of the middle class and the role of entrepreneurship in that rise. So they're very closely connected.
Other comments, questions?
Yes, although that list is currently under review, and we're changing that list. And by the way, you know, deliverable number one from this meeting this morning is that I hope that you'll help us spread the word about what we're doing, both in the U.S. government and among other potential partner organizations. And deliverable number two is that we are, at the beginning of 2011, just now revisiting our list of countries. So I'm very happy, ready, willing, interested, particularly from places like this, to get input about, you know, the challenge is that the list can't get bigger. It only can change components, but we have a limited number of resources. So we're hoping to do four countries deeply this year. And I do want to say, and I will give you the full list, but I do want to say that there is the full menu of our programs, which is what these focus countries are about. So that's the prefix menu, or it's Restaurant Week in Washington, so it's the prefix menu. There is also the a la carte menu. So there are countries that we work in that are not necessarily the full list of everything we do. They're not going to necessarily have the entrepreneur in residence, for example, but they may still have a delegation visit. They may still be places we work on starting angel networks. They certainly are places where we're going to participate in conferences and send speakers to try and raise the level of consciousness. So there are, but the countries are Algeria, Egypt, Haiti, Jordan, Indonesia, Lebanon, Mexico, Morocco, Pakistan, Palestinian territories, Peru, Philippines, Rwanda, South Africa, and Turkey. And I do have copies. I have a few hard copies of the partner package that are here if people want them. Or, as I said, they're available electronically if you want to contact us to talk about any more of this at entrepreneurship@state.gov.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Oscar. I also work at Site with Lorien. I want to go back to something that the gentleman over here mentioned earlier about 1978 and the Prudhoe Manual. You know, 1978 was also the year that the IRS added Section 401k, which created the retirement accounts, which became a giant pool of capital for venture capital and private equity. And also that year, the capital gains tax was a lot.
No, 401k. No. No.
I actually tried fighting for that back in the day.
But anyway, carry on.
Anyway. Also, capital gains slashed from 49 to 28% that year. I'm wondering, I don't know if there's a list of these kinds of policy changes in different countries out there, but I don't know if you have maybe one or two examples of those kinds of policies in the different countries where you work currently that are sort of on your radar in terms of getting capital and building the investment environment for an entrepreneurial economy?
Sure. I mean, one of the most, you know, one of the most basic indicators of a favorable business environment that goes into the World Bank indicator list, for example, is investment tax treatment. What is the regime in the country you're in? So that's front and center. As all of us know, this is again a subject that is only gray and not black and white, and it is something that we argue about in our country, you know, year in and year out ourselves. So I'm always reluctant to say to any country that, you know, we figured it out, here's how you do it. But you're quite right to point out that is one of the main drivers of you know, business creation is in investment tax treatment.
Yes.
Hi. Good morning. Daniel Kramer. Stephen, I wanted to ask you about your kind of entrepreneurial success, both personally and diplomatically, and if there's a deliverable that I, maybe some other people in this room, want from you, it's to know if there's been a couple maxims that kind of apply across the board and across the world that you kind of keep with you.
Well, everybody always asks me two questions. What is an entrepreneur? And what is the single most important thing to entrepreneurial success? So the answers to those questions, which I think bear on what you're saying, are an entrepreneur is somebody who has the vision for a new product, process, or service and the ability to make it happen. And the single most important criteria to be successful as an entrepreneur, and this is true whether you are in business or, frankly, what I consider what we're doing now at the State Department to be very much another entrepreneurial venture, is tenacity. You know, I would say it's the one most important thing. And it's difficult to keep going, and it's but there's no entrepreneur that I know of who's ever, first of all, who's ever been successful in every venture. So I'm a big believer in celebrating failures as well as successes. One of the things I say to people, and I said this in Egypt at the finale of the showcase, is you know, I would never invest in an entrepreneur who's never had a failure. Because I think you learn more from your failures than your successes. And I think you have to have a certain number of failures to get to the successes. So I would just assume you got it out of the way before I invest in you. So I'd like to know what they were. So it is very important, you know, we have this idealized, romanticized, fictionalized, Zuckerbergized view of, you know, what it's like to be an entrepreneur. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, you are no more likely to be Mark Zuckerberg than, you know, I am to perform open heart surgery in the middle of the room right now. I mean, that just doesn't happen. And so if we set that as this, and I personally think that it's a double-edged sword when we, you know, idolize some of these people. So I when I arrange these trips, I almost never try to bring entrepreneurs that are household names out into on these trips. Partly it's because I can never get them, and partly it's because I just think it's not realistic. The people who I like to bring on these trips or send out to speak are all successful. They all have and successful in a world-class sense, but they are not names that you will have heard of. You may have heard of their company, but you will probably not have heard of them. But they're also much more relatable. So, and by the way, I'm very focused on no tech, low tech, and high tech. So we don't only talk, especially in emerging market countries, we don't only talk about technology. We talk about Whole Foods. We talk about Starbucks. We talk about Walmart. We talk about CarMax. We talk about a lot of non-tech examples because in most of the world, you know, I don't say this when I'm there, but Indonesia is not likely to become a major center of nanotechnology innovation anytime soon. It is not what is going to create the 40 million jobs that Indonesia needs in the next 3 years. There are other sectors, and most of those are no-tech and low-tech, so we're very focused on those as well.
Okay, I think I'm going to suggest that we wrap up here. I'm hoping Steve might just stick around for a couple more minutes. I'm sure there'll be people that want to connect with Steve or others here individually. So I want to ask everybody to join me in thanking Steve Coltai.